Brother Deaton resides in Mesa, Arizona, and is a member of the Mesa Mountain View Stake. He and his wife, Susan, are the parents of 9 children, 6 boys and 3 girls. We might mention that they, as of today, have 18 grandchildren. They just added one more, so now they have 9 boys and 9 girls in their grandchildren. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Utah, his doctorate cum laude from Washington University in St. Louis. Brother Deaton is the founder and CEO of CUMA Learning Systems Incorporated and chief designer of CUMA's most sought-after seminars, including the Ownership Spirit Visioneering, Creating Connections, and Destination Thinking for Leaders. Among the clients for whom Brother Deaton has done extensive classroom training are Boeing, Charles Schwab, DuPont, Honeywell, Intel, Medtronic, Motorola, Quest, State Farm, Texas Instrument, and the University of Phoenix. Brother Deaton has taught numerous adult education courses for the church educational system since 1978 and is a regular member at BYU Campus Education Week. He's the author of the book Money, an Owner's Manual, the book on mind management, and the Ownership Spirit Handbook. Brother Deaton is the creator of an internationally acclaimed human development curriculum taught to tens of thousands of people annually in over 8 languages. He was born and raised in the church and served a full-time mission to Italy. He's held numerous leadership positions in the church, a counselor in stake presidency, stake young men's presidency, and president, high counselor, bishop's counselor, and elders' quorum president, and a branch president. We're grateful to have Brother Deaton with us. It was an opportunity to visit with him and his good companion and talk about how they came together, and he's playing baseball, I think, at CEU and Price, Utah, and how they've blessed each other's lives. And so we'll have the opportunity this time to hear from Brother Deaton.
Well, brothers and sisters, this is a singular experience to stand before you this afternoon in this particular capacity. I have had a number of opportunities to stand behind a podium and a pulpit. I've never felt greater responsibility to deliver a message of value and meaning than at this very moment. And I have been preparing as best I can, and with my own efforts, and most importantly, under the guidance of the Spirit, about which we're going to talk before we're done here today, fairly extensively. And I want you to know something, that I have had multiple witnesses over the last 5 months of who you are. And I am saying that from the standpoint that I have had some very distinct spiritual experiences about what to say. And along with that was a very strong witness of the Lord's great love for you and this great faculty and administration and the prophecies that have been, are in the midst of, and will be fulfilled upon this campus. I was thinking, I was sitting back here, that two of my teachers, mentors, role models have probably stood behind this podium many times. Henry B. Eyring, David A. Bednar. Not only spiritual giants, doctrinal giants. And that, again, is humbling. So, brothers and sisters, with the guidance of the Spirit, I'd like to share with you a few thoughts. I'm going to begin by sharing with you a little story. The story itself isn't true, but the setting in which I was told the story is. One of the joys I have in my life is I get to travel this planet. I've stood on 5 continents delivering the messages that we teach through my company to help build human beings in all walks of life, all levels of business, all sizes of business to be more effective in what they do. And I've had the opportunity of rubbing shoulders with some wonderful people. Maybe 8, 9 years ago, I was in a multi-day conference, went nearly a week, interacting with some entrepreneurs and business leaders from all walks of life, and I got to know a wonderfully charming Jewish woman. She was my senior by about 10 or 15 years and had just a very sharp, acute sense of humor. And near the end of the week, we were sitting in a banquet and She happened to be sitting right next to me at this table. And she said, Dr. Deaton, you're a Christian, right? And I said, well, I profess to be and I strive to be. And she said, well, then, I want to tell you a story. She says, Golda and Zelda were talking to each other. You listen to what I'm talking? Golda says to Zelda, Zelda, I send my son Oiving, that's with an I, to Israel to learn to be a good Jewish boy. And guess what? He comes home a Christian. Golda says to Zelda, funny you should mention that. I send my son Yitzhak, that's also with an I, to Israel to learn to be a good Jewish boy. And guess what? He too comes home a Christian. Zelda says to Golda, what should we do? And Golda says, let's go talk to the rabbi. So they go down and talk to the rabbi. And they say, rabbi, guess what? We send our two sons to Israel to learn to be good Jewish boys. And guess what? They come home Christians. And the rabbi says, funny you should mention that. I send my son Mendel, that's not with an I, to Israel to learn to be a good Jewish boy. And guess what? He too come home a Christian. And Zelda says to the rabbi, what should we do? The rabbi says, let's pray. So they pray and the rabbi takes the voice and he says, dear God, we send our sons to Israel to learn to be good Jewish boys and they come home Christians. And down came a cloud and there was a clap of thunder and a deep baritone voice that said, funny you should mention that. It took some of you a while to get that one. And some of you, I'm sure right now, haven't got it yet, but I just hope that we'll all start practicing laughing together. We'll never get out of here, and I've got a deadline here today. Now, I love that story, but it does teach false doctrine, because nothing takes the Lord and our Father in heaven by surprise. We are in the midst of a grand plan of happiness, which has some general milestones and ordinances and principles of the gospel that we have to obey in order to obtain the blessings that are appended to them. Now, brothers and sisters, along with that, I'm here to testify to you that each one of us within that grand plan have our own individual curriculum, so to speak. And when I accepted the opportunity to come here and speak, hung up the phone and said, I'll be there, it suddenly hit me that they didn't tell me what to talk about. So I'm assuming the posture that I'm going to talk to you about what I wish I had known. Maybe more importantly, what I wish I had really understood. Maybe more important than that, what I would have been able to practice when I was your age. And so the first thing I'd like you to consider is that I have learned that the earthly distinction that we continually make between temporal and spiritual is artificial, inaccurate, and counterproductive. The Lord, in the 29th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, as you know, said, wherefore, verily, I say unto you that all things unto me are spiritual. All things unto me are spiritual. And not at any time have I given unto you a law which was temporal. Neither any man nor the children of men, neither Adam, your father, whom I created. Now that's pretty strong, emphatic language. All things, not at any time have I given a law which is temporal, not to man, children of men, even right up to our father Adam. And so I'd like us to consider the idea that this idea that we have these compartments in our life is something that actually siphons energy from us. In our panel discussion this morning, we talked about the importance of balance, and I'd like to actually have you consider another concept. I think it's superior to balance. Balance is okay. Balance is going in the right direction. In fact, I'm going to talk about balance before we're done here today. But I want you to think about the importance of congruence. Because balance always kind of implies that it's a playoff, a trade-off, one thing against another. You have to subtract over here to add over here, or vice versa, to keep things in balance. And I believe that as Latter-day Saints, we have the advantage way over the world in that we can live a congruent life. I believe that each one of us can find our particular mission to perform in mortality. I call it our macro calling. I distinguish between a macro calling, which is our purpose in life or reason of being, and then our micro callings, which are the callings we have in the church. Now, by calling them micro callings, I'm not saying they're small and unimportant. That's the furthest thing that I want to imply here. You're magnifying your specific calling that you receive from your bishops and your stake presidents. That's imperative that you can do that to the maximum of your ability. But though that's really a subset of the fact of who you are and a conversation that I believe each one of us had before we came to this life, in which we sat down as though with a counselor, knowing who we were and the attributes and characteristics that we had perfected to the degree we could in the preexistence, and knowing what we still needed to acquire and gain and develop yet in order to become like the Father and the Son, and worked out with the Father and the Son an individualized curriculum in which we would experience certain experiences so that we would learn the things that we needed to round out so that we could indeed become perfect. And perfect does not mean flawless. It means complete, whole, well-rounded. So I'm going to say that I've had many callings. But I believe what I do for a living is the very purpose on which I'm on the earth right now. Now, I didn't find it immediately. Everybody's been calling me doctor all week, and I haven't let a lot of them in on the secret. When I stand in front of some of these corporate giants and they introduce me as doctor, I really am always sure that I'm going to get a laugh when I tell them that I have no training in organizational behavior, and that I'm not a psychologist, although most of my message is centered around mind management and thought processes. They almost faint when I tell them that my doctorate is in dentistry. And I can see how much it impressed you. Some of you are saying, if I'd known he's a tooth carpenter, I don't think I'd have come over here to, you know, this for him. Now, how does a dentist get from where you are to be the founder of a human development company and developing a curriculum? Well, it sometimes takes a while, a curriculum that's being taught to corporations anyway. It sometimes takes a while for you to take the steps where you're ready to find that, to discover it. Now, I know a lot of you want to know, and we're going to talk maybe even in the question and answer, about how the sooner you can find it, probably the better. But I'm also saying that some of this is in the timetable of the Lord. And you would not think that what I do for a living now, that dentistry would be the perfect preparation for it, but it turns out to be exactly that, the perfect preparation for what I'm doing. But let me just take a little step further. I graduated from Washington University in the top of my dental class. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to specialize or not. To go into specialty school, you had to be in the top of your class. I wanted to give myself at least the option. But when I got to that point, I loved all aspects of dentistry. If you go into oral surgery, then you have to give up the other parts. So I just loved all the parts of dentistry, so I didn't want to do that. So I became a general dentist and went out and found a place in the United States that needed some general dentists, and that was my wife's hometown of Price, Utah. And I hung up my shingle, and to my surprise and delight, there was demand for my services, and people came into my operatories, and sometimes they left some of their money there. And I was able to found a very profitable dental practice. And I'm getting now into my early 30s. I'm in the stake presidency. I'm on the institutional council of the College of Eastern Utah. I have either 8 and the 9th on the way, or have 9 children at that point. We have a lovely home. We're all in good health. And I'm restless. I believe that along with our mission, there comes a set of gifts. that are largely underdeveloped as we come into this world, and we move to develop them by what shows up inside of us as a desire, an urge. In entrepreneurship, we call it a passion. And I couldn't put my finger on it at first. I didn't know what it was. But I knew I was incomplete some way. And my greatest asset, the biggest blessing the Lord has ever given me, is my partnership and my marriage to the angel that sits behind me. And she said, "Why don't you go get your patriarchal blessing?" Now, some of you are saying, "How can that be?" Well, when I went into the mission field, back with Parley and Brigham, and you know, you weren't required to have a patriarchal blessing as you are today. I grew up in an inactive family. A lot of gospel things went through the cracks of our family. It was never actually encouraged. When I got into the mission field, I found out a lot of my companions had these blessings, and sometimes they'd read bits and pieces to me, and they all started sounding the same. They're all from Ephraim, going to meet a wonderful girl. If they keep the commandments, they're going to rise in the morning of the first resurrection. And I thought, well, why do you have to have one of those? Because if you don't keep the commandments, you're not going to get those blessings even that they're promised, and I'm going to do that, so I don't need to have somebody tell me I'll get the blessings. I know I'll get the blessings. So I got into being about 33 years old and never had my patriarchal blessing. And my patriarch was actually shocked as a member of the stake presidency when I called him up for an appointment to get my blessing. When I got my blessing, it was 11 paragraphs long, 7 paragraphs talked about teaching. One phrase in the blessing says that I would take the principles of the gospel and put them into lesson plans that would help people around the world understand the gospel message. Now, I believe that you and I have to do everything in our power to make those blessings come to pass. So I decided, well, that's going to mean a little shift in my emphasis, you know, putting cotton balls in people's mouth and trying to tell jokes. I'm going to have to do a little different thing. So I commenced on that and started looking for ways that I could get involved with public speaking and eventually developed some seminars for dentists and started doing a little bit of that. But then I started getting some calls from people that weren't dentists. And I started talking to my very good friend who was in the real estate business. And I said, "What do you think if we actually created a little seminar business?" Didn't start with a real business plan or anything like that. We just took each of us $50,000 and capitalized our little business. And we started sending out direct mail marketing to dentists to get them to come into a 2-day practice management seminar that we called Dental Practice with Peace of Mind. And it grew feebly. And we did get a few callbacks here. And as I said, some of the dentist friends who weren't dentists called us up to do a few little seminars. But we blew through our $100,000 pretty fast. And there was a day when I was sitting in my dental office in which I quit. I was just thinking about, this is stupid. You know, I've got a wonderful profession. Why do I even want to put that in jeopardy? Spend more time on my calling. Spend more time with my family. We're just pouring money down a hole. Maybe this is just an ego trip anyway. And kind of talked myself into, right as soon as I finished my last patient, I was going to walk down to my friend's office, who was just 2 doors down, and I was going to walk into Reese's office and I'm going to say, "Reese, it's been great, but you know, let's get realistic. This isn't going to go anywhere. We're just going to put good money after bad." And I was prepared to go in there and quit. And felt kind of good about it. I hadn't studied and prayed and DC-9'd it and got a confirmation, but it, you know, felt pretty good, and went in and continued to work on my patients. And a little while later, my head office person came in and said, "Dr. Deaton, there's a person on the phone who wants to talk to you." And His name is Jeff Bishop, and he's from Dothan, Alabama. Dothan, Alabama, it was such a weird location. I said, I don't know him from Dothan, but I went and I answered the phone, and Jeff Bishop on the phone there and said, Dennis, you don't know me. You recommended me. I have a good friend, a dentist. He says, I'm a businessman in Dothan, Alabama, and every year I bring in a top-quality speaker. I invite the entire state. It's a way I build business, a way I give back to my community. I'm going to have the governor there. I'm going to have the mayor of Dothan, Alabama. I'm going to have senators there. I'm going to have businessmen there. And I've just been told that you're a great speaker, and I want you to come out and give that message. And he said, are you open on such and such a date? And I said, let me see. I set the appointment and told him what I would charge for that. And I went back to and picked up the instruments and went on with the afternoon. And I just felt like that was a message from the Lord telling me that I was to pursue this, that I wasn't to stop, that this was not a coincidence. And he'd made the location, this Dothan, Alabama, bizarre enough that it would just seem like it couldn't have been a coincidence. And so I went to Dothan, Alabama, and I showed up there. And this Jeff Bishop, I guess, really was somebody, because it was a school auditorium, and they packed the place, and the governor was there. It wasn't Bill Clinton. And no, that was Arkansas anyway. Anyway, the point was, this place was packed, and I'm over here in the wings, and I'm thinking, can I do this? I was scared stiff. And he gave me this generous introduction, and I walked out on stage. And I thought, oh my word. And I know there's many in this room that have had the experience that comes next, when you feel like you're totally inadequate for the occasion, but you turn to the Lord and say, help! And he comes through. And the Spirit came over me, and I really do not know what I said, but I went for about an hour and raised the roof, so to speak, and it wasn't me, but it was the power of the Spirit, and there was a standing ovation at the end. And at the end of that speech, and I just was just basking in the Spirit, the Lord was telling me, this is what you're supposed to do, and I was then given a lovely parting gift, or a speaker's acknowledgement here. And I opened it up, and in it was a stainless steel peanut next to my wedding ring. It is one of my cherished personal possessions, the stainless steel peanut. It's on a bookshelf in my office. It's a place where my eye can track over it from time to time. And Jeff Bishop stood up and said, Dennis, you know what Dothan's famous for? I said, I don't know. And he said, we're the peanut capital of the world. And he said, so that you'll always remember Dothan, we're going to present you the stainless steel peanut. And it was just in a little box. He hadn't said it was a peanut inside, but when I opened up and I saw that stainless steel peanut, I heard the voice. Even if you have to work for peanuts, I'm asking you, I'm calling you to do this. That was transformational for me. It's been something I reflected back on many times as I've gone through the ups and downs of entrepreneurship and building a business. There have been good times, there have been bad times, but I've never doubted what I'm supposed to do. And because of that, and Susie's witness that that was the case, we've always been congruent. When I'm out of the home, she's in the home, but we're working together to take the messages that the Lord's giving us to speak to the world together. So that when I'm on the road, I'm not away from the home. I'm not doing temporal things at the expense of spiritual things. It's all one for us. And that is something that I believe every one of us can do and orient ourselves to understand how to approach our life and our businesses and our activities so that they're all one. They're all under serving the Lord through our macro mission by these small incremental components of it, our church callings and the things that are required of us from time to time as we go through the chapters in our business. So I want to say that, and along with that, I want to say, along with our callings are these unique gifts, a set of gifts that most of them are undeveloped, and we have to pursue them by developing according to our righteous desires, and that's why we need to follow Elder Maxwell's counsel to cultivate righteous desires. If I were to give you an admonition regarding a specific thing to include in your prayers frequently, if not daily, is to ask the Lord to bless you with righteous desires, because ultimately those are the driving forces that keep us going in whatever direction we go with the energy to persist and continue on. And then maybe the most important thing under that category is that only through the guidance of the Spirit and the blessings, and oftentimes we're talking miracles, of the Lord, can we successfully fulfill our missions. And I think that we need to be much more oriented to using the spiritual gifts that we are entitled to in this church to build up our businesses and fulfill our missions through the gifts and guidance of the Spirit. I can't tell you how many times I have felt the Lord take me to the level that I needed to be, help me to accomplish things that I wasn't even necessarily aware at the moment that I need to accomplish in that given setting. I'll just give you a very quick one. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was called by a stake presidency in St. George to give a speech at an Eagle Neck recognition banquet. It wasn't really part of my profession or my church calling. It wasn't a church speech. It was a Boy Scout speech, but the majority of the attendants there were told we're going to be Latter-day Saints and their families, and this was a banquet that was going to be given to all the boys who had gotten their Eagle rank during the year, and they wanted a keynote speaker, and they heard that I had a good message for youth, and they invited me to go there, and I did. And so I'm now 6 hours away from St. George. Susan's mother lives in St. George. We were going to go there, change my clothes, and go on to this Eagle recognition banquet. And I'd been on the road a lot, busy. I hadn't really dedicated time to prepare a message. And what I did is I thought, I'll just kind of get it together as I'm driving. So I talked my youngest son, David, who was about 16, 15 at that time, to come with me on this trip, get some quality time with the son. And I grabbed a file out of my filing cabinet, which said youth talks. And over the years, you know, those of you who do any speaking, or if you don't, you will be doing speaking. If you're standing up front of people, motivating people as a business leader and attracting venture capital, you got to make your case. So start building your speaker's file. Every time you come across a poem, a scripture, a story, something that hits you that's got value, you just file it into one of these files. So I just grabbed my youth speech file. I don't know it at the time, but for a reason you're soon going to see, there were 53 pieces of paper in that file. So at a certain point, David and I are driving out of Phoenix, heading up towards St. George, and after we'd had a lot of father and son talk and getting caught up on a lot of things, I said, David, I need to have you help me with my talk. Grabbed the file out of my briefcase, and he sat on his lap, and I said, okay, I just want you to just start reading the first line on every page, or tell me what the title is, or tell me what it is, and then I'm going to have you divide it in two piles. You're going to make one pile just to the left and one to the right, and basically in my mind, what's going to go to the right is something that he read that I might possibly use in this setting that felt like it would fit into the talk. And so David read it out, no, it goes over here, and so we go through this, and by the time we have gone through the entire file, there are 11 pieces of paper in the possibly could use file. And by that time, we were getting into St. George and stopped in my mother-in-law's home, changed her clothes, and got ready to go to the banquet. I had just enough time to sit down with those 11 pieces of paper and kind of go through that sorting process one more time, and sorted them once again, and wound up with 6 pieces of paper that I thought would be possible parts of the talk. In fact, I thought, okay, I could go that one, and that one, and that one. Okay, and I had my outline. And I went over to the banquet, and they served us dinner, and then they had the after-dinner speaker, and that was me. And I stood up, and again, had one of those experiences, and I'm kind of having one right now again, where the Spirit takes over a lot more than you actually thought it would or might. And I gave a good message and wound up only using 1 of the 6 of the 11 of the 53. It was a poem I'd heard as a boy, wasn't all that impressed with it, actually, but it was, maybe could be useful at some time. It was called The Man in the Mirror, The Man in the Glass. It's about if you can look the man in the mirror in the eye and feel good about it, that you're living an upright life. And I wove that, and it kind of became the centerpiece of that talk. When I sat down, the person who was going to conclude the meeting stood up, and she was crying. She's a district executive there, and she was crying. And she was saying, well, what we had planned, and Brother Deedon didn't know this, is to send every one of you Eagle Scouts away with a special gift. And she said, we had to order these. There wasn't enough of them around in the stores. We had to special order them. This happened, she said, 6 weeks ago when we got them in. Then we took them to an engraver to have something else done with them. And what she was talking about is she was giving them all one of these Boy Scout signaling mirrors, those khaki cases. And then she pulled it out, and she said, and what we have inscribed on the back is a poem, The Man in the Glass. You tell me that's a coincidence. You tell me the Lord doesn't work with us in our work. I will not accept that. I know that the Lord leads and guides and directs us, and we need to learn how to participate with the Lord more fully so that we're congruent and whole. Second lesson here, and I think I'm going to have to hit the clutch on this and speed this up. Number two, I have learned the power of the Calpurnia principle when it comes to making business and financial decisions. Sean Witten, in his closing remarks in the panel discussion, nailed it. It was just so interesting, and so much what we talked about in the panel is what the Lord has really asked me to put into this talk here. The Calpurnia principle. Those of you who stayed awake in your Shakespearean classes know that Calpurnia is Julius Caesar's wife, and she was the one that got the warning dream on the 14th of March that Caesar should not go to Senate on the Ides of March. Had Caesar listened to his compliment, not with an I, but with an E. I'm not talking about a favorable a statement. I'm talking about something that completes and makes perfect. A compliment is one of two mutually completing parts. Had he listened to his compliment, he would not have met his demise on the Ides of March. And I'm telling you here, and I think I got the feeling that every one of the entrepreneurs over here said, and it doesn't matter, this is not a male or female thing, even though we're calling it Calpurnia principle. Listen to your spouse. You are a complement. What one lacks, the other has. What you have, the other one might lack, and you come together as a whole, and you need to work together. Now, there were some times in my arrogant interpretation of what the patriarchal order meant was that I was boss, and basically Susan just helped me out to accomplish what I needed to do. And when I made a decision, sometimes I run by her and sometimes I went. And if she didn't agree with it, that was okay. I'm the boss. I'm going to do it. Failure after failure after failure. I started picking up the pattern that when I made prideful decisions, making the decision on my own, I can't remember an instance where it worked or worked well. And I started realizing every time I sat down with Susan and talked it through that she was a perfect Liahona. If she could understand it and she felt good about it and she approved it, then it worked. And that was a very, very high batting average. I can't remember a financial or business decision that's ever been a real disaster where I've really followed that counsel. And to be tested on that, there was a time after I'd gotten the Calpurnia principle and made my commitment that I was really going to live by it. somebody came on up to me with a business proposition, and I went through it, and I looked at the spreadsheets, and I did my checking, did my homework, and I worked out the numbers myself, and boy, did it look good. And man, you know, I could see these big numbers falling down at the bottom, and I went in there and said, Susan, look at this. Man, this is a great opportunity, and we got to do this, and but that's doable for us, and look at the numbers. And Susan looked at it, and she asked a few questions about it, and I tried to explain that. She says, okay, I understand how that'll work. I don't feel good about it.
Whoa, what? Come on, woman. Can't you read the numbers there, you know?
We're going to be rich, you know. And very reluctantly, I said, okay, I'm going to go, because I've used it in my seminars and in church talks, I'm going to go with this. We're not going to go into this. Brothers and sisters, it was not 6 months that I was literally coming back into my kitchen one day and falling at her ankles going, thank you, thank you. Because that venture turned out to be the biggest boondoggle and disaster, and people that I knew and friends that had went to it were very regretful that they had done that. Counsel with your partner, whether he or she is a part of your business. Do not make any decisions of that magnitude without having prayer and have a confirmation of it between the two of you. Number three, I have learned the supernal importance of complementary relationships, which I've just alluded to, and balance. Now, we're talking about balance in a different way than balancing your time. I'm talking about, well, let me just talk about it in athletics. As I was mentioned, it was mentioned in the introduction, whether you can tell it or not, up here at one time, I did have some athletic background. And any of you that have been in athletics know that the most powerful and strategic position you can be in to perform well in your respective sport is to be in balance. There might be an exception, but you talk about gymnastics, you talk about shooting free throws, shooting jump shots, passing a football. Well, that was an off-balance throw. That's why we hear all of that. It's absolutely imperative that we be in balance. And all things testify of Christ. And you and I are bilaterally symmetrical organisms. We have two shoulders, two arms, two legs. When our weight is equally distributed on both of those legs, we're in balance. We're ready to leap, perform, dodge, whatever we need to do as long as we're in balance. Now, I'm going to say that there's more misery spiritually, temporally, in business and so forth because most of us Latter-day Saints really do not understand the important balance that comes between two complementary principles. The first principle is self-reliance. You were brought to this earth, and so was I, to experience challenge and adversity and to develop strength in the form of self-reliance. Now, people who only develop that don't succeed. Now, the other complementary principle is reliance on the Lord. Those two have to be kept in equal balance. You need to be promoting them equally. And to over-promote one or the other is just as absurd and ineffective as if you're an athlete and you only developed one side of your body. So let me read something from a welfare handbook. I was told by a general authority that when the general authorities wanted to hide something from the saints, they put it in a handbook. But listen to the wisdom in this statement from our welfare handbook. We cannot earnestly teach and urge members to be self-sustaining. We must earnestly teach and urge members to be self-sustaining to the fullest extent of their power. Self-sustaining to the fullest extent of their power. No Latter-day Saint will voluntarily shift from himself or herself the burden of support. So long as, this referring to the man, so long as he can, under the inspiration of the Almighty and with his own labors, he will supply himself with the necessities of life. Now, I think I I need to clarify what I just said, because I made it sound like it was gender-based there. We must teach the Latter-day Saints to be self-sustaining to the fullest extent of their powers, so long as they can, under the inspiration of the Almighty and with their own labors, He will supply them with the necessities of life. President Gordon B. Hinckley, how we love him. I believe in the gospel of work. There's no substitute under heaven for productive work. It is the process by which dreams become realities. It is the process by which idle visions become dynamic achievements. Most of us are inherently lazy. We would rather play than work. We would rather loaf than work. A little play and a little loafing are good. But it is work that spells the difference in the life of a man or woman. It is stretching our minds and utilizing the skills of our hands that lift us from mediocrity. We cannot deny the need for work with skilled hands and educated minds if we were to grow and prosper individually and if our nation is to stand tall and stand tall before the world. I love Brigham Young and the practical theology that he taught. He said, brothers and sisters, if we ever walk in streets paved with gold, it will be because we go up into the mountains and we prospect the ore, we smelled it, refined it, we pound it into sheets, and we put it there. And that's the kind of attitude we have to have about our businesses and our careers and our education and everything else we do, including our yard work, that we need to be picturing ourselves as needing to develop greater strength and greater self-reliance. And yet, if we go too far in that direction and forget that the key of working with the Lord is to work with the Lord, then we're going to forfeit the greatest help we can possibly have, and that is the inspiration and guidance of the Lord Himself. From Preach My Gospel, page 97, some of you in the room probably have it memorized. As the Lord's servant, and are we not all the Lord's servant? Don't have to be on a full-time mission to be the Lord's servant. As the Lord's servant, you are to do His work in His way and by His power. Some feel confident that they know how to be successful. Others lack such confidence. Remember, however, that your confidence and faith should be in Christ, not yourself. Rely on the Spirit rather than your own talents and faculties. Trust the Spirit to guide you in every aspect of your work. And from Brigham, here's a reminder for all of us. There is no doubt if a person lives according to the revelations given to God's people, he may have the Spirit of the Lord to signify to him His will and to guide and to direct him in the discharge of his duties in his temporal as well as spiritual exercises. But I am satisfied, however, that in this respect, we live far below our privileges. So I'd like to move to the fourth point. I have learned that there is great power in remembering that I am a steward in all things. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and they that dwell therein. And this principle of servant leadership is something that I have grown to appreciate the magnitude and power and importance of it. Brothers and sisters, your strength is not your own. Some of us have a workout program and we see the strength coming into our bodies as we work them. That can be taken away from us in just a matter of seconds. I have a very good friend, David Treat, invested in my business, who was coming home from a trip. His daughter was, 20-year-old daughter was driving the van, fell asleep, one car roll over. And when I go see my friend David Treat these days, the only way I can shake hands with him is to put my hand on his temple. There's just a little spot on the side of his cheek where he has any feeling. The fact right now that you can take a deep breath is a gift of the Lord. Now, the Lord has given you and I the gift to exercise those and grow strong with the hope that we'll be wise enough to use that strength to help others along the path, those that are less strong. Very quickly, a few years ago, oldest five children, oldest girl, four boys, going on a hike. We're going to go to Fossil Springs on a hike in Arizona. Two ways you can go to Fossil Springs. You can drive to a road at the bottom, but the best way, the funnest way, is to park on a mesa at the top, hike down this big, steep switchback, hike on in, spend a few days, hike back out the same way. So that's the way we did it. We all had our bedrolls. We're going to pack in. It was wilderness camp. We're going to pack everything in, pack everything out. Had a great time. Kind of always pictured I was going to be there with my five kids, you know, and these wonderful father's son-daughter family experience around the campfire, kumbaya, you know, and playing Yahtzee. It was just going to be great. And we started back out to climb the way home. My oldest daughter, April, has had some health problems, and so I started gearing the hike out according to the pace that April could manage. And I had two sons that were younger than April, but they were getting into their testosterone spurt, and they could really feel the strength in their bodies coming. And they were absolutely appalled that every 15 or 20 minutes we were stopping to rest, because they, you know, could still feel the strength, and they were going to climb out of this ever-increasing incline going up. And there started to be actually tension within our group, the antithesis of what I'd been hoping for as a parent. And then I said a little prayer, and inspiration of the Lord came, and I said, I want you to think about something here, just not talking to anybody in specific, but just in general. One of the things I love about the Lord Jesus Christ is that he has used his strength to come back and help those of us who are weaker. I shudder to think, my loving children, where we would be if he had the attitude that was all about how far he could go and how fast he could climb and how soon he could get his destination. For him, it was how, not only do I want to go home to the Father, it's a matter of how many people I can bring with me. So I'm telling all of you that you don't need to stay. I'm going to pace this out with April. But if you want to go ahead, you can go. So when we put our packs on and started out, two of my sons went on. And my other two sons and April and I, we went along and we periodically stopped. And then we finally came to the point where we're going to make the last climb. It's almost a quarter mile and you can see the parking lot. And we rounded this bend and started up that incline, and April's by me. And one of the most cherished memories in my life is to see my son Jacob, without his pack, coming back down the incline. He walks for a while, then he trots, then he runs. And he is at a full run when he comes up to his sister April and said, April, I would really like to carry your pack up the rest of this hill. Now, to April's credit, she would have none of that. She says, I'm not going to go to every family reunion, every family home, even hear how you had to pack my pack out of here. I'm packing this up. And she did. But one of the choicest visions I've had is seeing Jacob and April with her pack, and those two holding hands going up that incline together. And you're going to make a lot of money, a lot of you in this room. And you need to know that it's not to be consumed upon your lust. I know I'm pushing time here, and that's tough. Anyway, I'll wrap it quickly here. You need to understand something, that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And I want to read you carefully something from Brigham and then apply it. Brigham said, it is our duty, individually as well as our privilege, to learn how to dispose of the earthly wealth we may possess to the glory of him who has permitted us to hold it. For in temporal blessings, honestly obtained and wisely placed to their legitimate use, are concealed mines of spiritual and eternal wealth. There is a backbone that goes down North America. It starts up in Canada and ends up in Arizona. It is symbolic of something that is true on the church right now. The economic backbone of the church is the income that is generated by tithes and offerings in that sector of the church. Every other sector of the church is subsidized by the tithes and offerings that's coming down the Rocky Mountain backbone. One of the reasons why we're not into China or India right now is not just the language and not just the number of missionaries. We're going to need money to finance that. And some of you will be tested on this. You're going to maybe right out of the chute make some pretty good money on some of your entrepreneurial endeavors. And if you turn that into consuming it on the largest house, two or three cabins, cars, consuming it on your last, yeah, you'll give your tithes, but if you're miserly with that, I promise you, you'll experience some reversals. The Lord's going to love you too much to let you lust your way into the lower kingdom, and you'll come to understand that your income is a gift of the Lord too. You have to do everything you can. You're going to have to pay all those prices we talked about, but you're being blessed so that you can live the law of consecration. And those that think you have to live in Orderville, Utah to live consecration are wrong. You set yourself a budget, live modestly, live well, but do not overdo it. Add to your fast offering. Put it into the perpetual education fund. When the Lord knows he can trust you, I promise you, you'll be multiplied in your blessings. Now, I'll give you one final testimony of that. There's a man in my ward. He's a partner in the strongest, most prosperous attorney firm, law firm in Mesa, Arizona. I have just a little bit of a glimpse of the income he makes. He could pay cash easily for a Lamborghini, and he could have the largest home in the state, but he doesn't. He has a 12-year-old, faded, yellow Buick, LeSabre Skylark. They don't even make the model anymore. And he takes his excess, and he consecrates to the church. I can't wait to see the mansion and the cabin and the boat he's got waiting for him on the other side. The Lord's already got it for us. I testify that if we keep our priorities straight, that if we'll work our hardest and we'll pray unto the Lord for revelation, be quick to obey his voice, we will be in balance. And we will experience the great joy of feeling his sweet spirit guide us and direct us and bless us in everything we do. Of that I testify in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.